Welcome to the Masterlink podcast with James and Stefan. Getting to know creatives in the music industry. Available on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you like our podcast, you can support us on patreon.com/masterlinksessions. Hi everyone, welcome to the Masterlink podcast. My name's James.
Hey, it's Stefan here, and today we're talking to Michael Bandur.
Yes,
how
you nailed
you?
It. You nailed it. Thank
audience,
you.
Audience, did you hear the clarity that which Stefan pronounced Michael's name?
Yes, it was beautiful. You just made my whole day. Thank you.
Only took 35 minutes of practice beforehand.
That's right.
Michael, I'm really excited to have you on. It's so nice to, as Stefan's been telling me about your podcast and when you interviewed him. So now it's our turn to, I want some interviews, probably a strong word, but have a nice conversation with you.
Yeah.
And for our listeners who don't know who you are yet, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself?
I would be happy to. First of all, James and Stefan, thank you so much for having me here. It is a real pleasure. And I'm a fan of your podcast as well. So I appreciate you having me on here.
Cool.
So my name is Michael Bandur. I just go by Michael B most of the time, just because it's easier to pronounce and you don't have to worry about a spelling. But among other things, I am a musician. I'm a singer-songwriter. I play guitar in one band and sing, and I play bass and sing in another band. But my latest things that I've been pursuing are related to funk music in particular. I launched a radio show back in 2020 on the Oklahoma City NPR affiliate. That's KGOU, and the show is a two-hour instrumental funk, groove, soul, disco, jazz, and hip-hop show that explores music from the 1960s to the 2020s.
Mm-hmm. It's called... Hell it's, yeah!
Oh, it's so much... It is so much fun. It's called Tonic the Funky Groove Show. And then in August of 2021, I decided after months and months of preparation to take the big leap, and I left a 15-year career in public relations in academia and launched a podcast called 40 Minutes of Funk, which is an interview-based podcast that also features the music of the very best of funk practitioners from across the globe. And that's where I met Stefan. I reached out to him over Instagram, and he was actually one of those musicians who checks Instagram messages and wrote back and said, yes. So that's in a nutshell.
I love it.
And kind of some of the things that I'm doing.
And I have in your bio that you're also a painter. You're an avid abstract painter, which is really exciting.
Yeah, that's another new venue for me. I worked for 10 years at an art museum as a PR guy. And part of that was that I'm a very creative, artistic person. I love art. And so I spent a number of years developing an appreciation for viewing art. And then figuring out kind of what my favorite kinds of art were, which is abstract expressionism and surrealism. And during the pandemic in December of 2020, I started dreaming about painting. And that had never happened to me before. And actually, I woke up in the middle of the night one night and just was like, I don't know if you guys are like this, if you've ever had these sort of creative mania moments where you have to make something. As a musician, it's pretty easy. You pick up a guitar, you pick up an instrument, and you start writing or playing, right? Well, I had this crazy drive to create something artistic, and all I had in my bedside table were colored pencils, which is like the absolute worst medium of all. But I got up and I just started scribbling. And like, I spent 2 hours just scribbling out ideas for paintings. And then, and my wife, of course, woke up and she came in there with me and she's like, what are you doing? And I was like, I don't even know, but I can't not do this right now. I think I'm going to have to buy some paints. And so I did. And I've just sort of been developing my painting for the past year and been loving it. Just having a great time doing that.
Wow.
Brilliant.
That's amazing.
I think that's brilliant. I mean, I have to say though, why did your wife not ask, why do you have pencil, like color pencil on your bedside table? I mean, that would have been like maybe more the question, but
okay.
I had them
there because I was using them as a highlighter. Like I was using the bright colors as a highlighter in the books that I was reading.
Okay? Oh, there you go.
Just
there you go.
So nobody.
Oh, gotcha.
As soon as I said that, I thought, shit, somebody's going to think this guy's back at school. For keeping colored pencils. No, I was out of highlighters. So all I had was like a box of colored pencils that probably my daughter got from somewhere. So
brilliant.
Thank you. Excellent evidence. Yes, fine. Michael, I gotta ask you, like, I mean, I don't know where to start here.
Yeah,
but,
where do
know,
we start? There's so much there.
You send us your resume and you send us your bio, and it's kind of a kaleidoscope of activity. You know, there's loads of interesting things going on, all at a very high level. You're clearly a very high achiever person, which is very impressive and respectable. And maybe my first question was, when you said you left a life in academia to set up a podcast, I simply ask, what took you so long?
Money.
All right.
I had worked myself into a place where I finally was making the money that I felt like I had earned and had worked towards for so long. It was a great place of safety. Had great insurance, all of the perks that you would get from a great, you know, full-time job. When the pandemic hit, they sent all of us home. And all of a sudden, I had the very best work environment I had ever had. Now, I had worked with some great people. And I got to say that the office mates that I had before that were some of the best team that I'd ever been with. We had so much fun working together. But the pandemic pushed everybody home. And all of a sudden, I could telecommute. And I could do my job without professors opening up my door and saying, hey, I know you're really busy, but can you stop what you're doing and do this thing for me that they think takes 30 seconds that actually takes 4 hours? And not to bash, you know, professors, I know that we've got at least one person on this call who has done some teaching in the past. But I realized that I could be super productive at home. And at that point, I was already doing my radio show from home. And I got to a point where I just was really unhappy doing the work of a desk job, 40-hour work type of profession. As I mentioned, I'm very creative. And, you know, I've had lots of conversations with my wife, and she's super supportive. She's seen me through, you know, some really tough times occupationally. And she actually was the one who said, well, why don't you quit your job and pursue creativity full time? And I have to say that I had done a similar thing for her because she went back to school and pursued her master's and her PhD in counseling psychology. So I knew what it felt like to hold down the house and to raise the kid and to pay the bills while she pursued something that was really important to her. Mm. And so she turned the tables and said, it's your turn. You know, she said, I got this. So that was really the impetus behind what took me so long was I had to have sort of the right dominoes in place to do that. And I'm just super lucky that I have such a great supportive partner. And she was the one who said, yes, do it. Now, there was this big gap where I went from, okay, yeah, that sounds great. I don't know if I can do this. I don't know. Yeah, I've got this sort of pride issue that I should be the one who's still doing my part. but also, what in the hell am I going to do with myself? What am I going to do that is going to be productive and going to be something that can eventually help bring in some money? And so, like, you know, the radio show brings in a little bit of money. Basically, it's my car payment every month. So that's great. That covers that. Podcast doesn't bring in any money at this point, but no podcast ever does unless a celebrity launches one. It takes time to build that up. And the paintings, I've sold a few paintings, and but everything right now is leading up to potential. So the podcast is something I really believe in. I think it has a lot of potential to get traction and to get listeners and eventually to get financial support. The paintings are kind of the same way. I'm just at the point where I've got to start launching into the local community and getting into art shows and festivals and things like that. So again, that has potential. So right now it's just working on creating a consistent quality product, whether that is the podcast, the radio show, paintings, even, you know, to an extent, the music that I make with my bands.
Wow. What kind of time frame are we? When did you leave your job in PR?
So that was at the end of August. So August 31st, 2020 was my last day.
Yeah. Oh, no, sorry, 2020. Okay, fine. Okay.
No, 2021.
Yeah,
so I keep forgetting we're in a new year. Yeah.
Well, everybody does. Everybody's got that issue with that 1 year.
So it hasn't been right. That's so cool. And so how is the shift? Because I'm assuming, like you say, it's a 40-hour week. You've got deadlines, you've got things to do, you've got a to-do list, blah, 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 blah. You've got people asking you to do stuff, and now you're a free man.
That's right.
How do you quantify going from that side to completely free? How's that shift been for you?
Well, I'm very organized, I work very hard, and I want everything that I do to excel to the best possible degree that I can. So I put everything I've got into everything that I do. And it's just my work ethic. I've just always been that way. And so one of the first things that I was doing moving towards this transition was that very thing. What am I going to do with my time? And so I basically I've got a rough schedule. The thing about working from home and being self-employed is that your schedule can change at any moment. And any number of any dumb things that are not related to your job can show up and just, you know, train wreck your plans. So part of what I'm doing through all of this is learning to flow and learning to go with the changes, to roll with the changes. I've had days where I've had to go get my car fixed. Well, it's not related to my job, but that's a 4 hour or a 6 hour or a whole day out of my productivity that I've got to work around. And being the kind of organized person that I am, just going with the flow is a new kind of a concept for me. And you can ask any of my band members, they'll tell you that. In fact, the two guys that I play with in Heartbreak Rodeo, they call me Electro Boy, because when we show up to a gig, I'm hitting the ground running. I'm plugging stuff in. I'm setting things up. I want to start on time, you know? So I have a schedule. So like Monday is basically dedicated to my radio show. Tuesday is any leftover radio show and working on my next podcast. Wednesday, I have to get my podcast edited because my deadline is Thursday morning it launches. And if I get all of that stuff done, then Friday is supposed to be a day that I can work on art. Now, again, anything can happen. Any of that stuff changes. Sometimes my radio show takes longer to plan or prepare. I have to prepare research and questions for my podcast guests. I've got to book guests. I've got to interview them. So that sort of falls in amongst wherever I can fit, because I've got to also work with my podcast guests' schedules, and there's no telling when they're available to meet and do interviews. So, you know, I think a lot of it is just having a plan and then trusting the universe and trusting myself if that plan gets out of whack.
I love it. And you have a daughter as well. Just to throw into the mix as well.
I do, but she's 18. She just turned 18, and she has been 18 or older since she was about 6 years old. She's very independent, very smart. Yeah, she's such an easy, like, she's such a cool person, and just, you know, she's known how to take care of herself and things for a long time. So
brilliant, I love that.
Yeah, and honestly. Great. Honestly, that's probably another factor for why now is that I've got a kid who's almost grown up and she'll be going to college, and I'm at a place where I don't have my parental duties are way less than they've ever been and growing less every day. So
he says with a big smile on his face.
Yeah, totally. Dude, when she turned 16 and got a car, that was one of the best days ever because she was so involved. She had volleyball and stuff that she was doing. And, you know, when you live in, you got to drive 45 minutes one way to take her to volleyball practice. That gets old really fast. So yeah, when she turned 16, I was like, see ya.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
All to come for you, James.
I've got a few years. Yeah, I've got at least 15 years before.
Oh wow!
Before my little boy has figured out what on earth if he will drive. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah,
brilliant. I'd like to talk about the show, the podcast itself. So,
sure.
I think you mentioned somewhere that you very broad taste in music. You like a lot of music, different types of music. But somehow you kind of settled on the funk theme for now. So
yeah,
what's behind that?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I am a singer-songwriter, and I've been writing music for a long time, writing songs. And my sort of default genre for writing and for listening years ago sort of settled into acoustic rock, what you might call alternative country, not really country or twangy, but, and I just listened to that kind of stuff all the time. And I have no qualms with that music. I mean, there's still a lot of music in my collection that is in, you know, those lines, like your Jason Isbell's, who's a big, you know, in that sort of vein right now. And, Sunvolt and Whiskey Town and just all of these sort of country rock bands that aren't really like Nashville country, but have got a country style to them. And I play in two bands. One of them is an acoustic rock band, and we have a country sound, but we're not twangy at all. And the other is a little bit more Americana, coffee house sort of a style. But whenever I kind of went through this transition where when I took the newest job that I had had, which I had for 3 years before I left. And when I moved into that new office, I thought, you know what? I'm tired of listening to the same music on my iTunes. And I had a catalog of like 12,000 albums. I mean, just like an incredible amount of music, but I was always recycling it. I was always just listening to kind of the same things. And a good buddy of mine, who I'm going to name drop because he'll listen to this, is one of my best friends on the planet. His name's Doug Lewis. He was really getting into Snarky Puppy and into, you know, the Corey Wongs and the sort of the bands that were the outliers of that sort of funk jazz stuff. And I do have a huge, I love a lot of music. In fact, I mean, I grew up in a household where we were listening to different stuff all the time. My brother is a huge fan of Rush. He had in his bedroom, he had every record of Rush tacked on his wall, like literally hanging on his wall was every vinyl record in chronological order of Rush.
Yes.
Right. And my dad liked jazz and pop music. And so we were always just listening to all kinds of stuff. And it's funny, I remember making a mixtape for myself that had Run DMC, Raising Hell on one side, and Neil Sedaka's Greatest Hits on the other.
Mind bender.
Right, right. So I've just all my whole life, I've loved like lots of different kinds of music, but, and I have loved funk at a distance. I've kind of been aware of funk, you know, since I was a teenager. I liked to watch Shaft and the black action films that had such incredible soundtracks and stuff. I played Toe Jam and Earl, which is this amazing video game that was on the Sega Genesis.
I'm with you.
You know it, James? and the guys that programmed that, they programmed a funk soundtrack that was inspired by Herbie Hancock. So this really great funk, you know, soundtrack. Anyway, so
8-bit soundtrack. It's brilliant.
Yeah. And it's fantastic for
it's
that.
Really good. But,
yeah. And so I started kind of down the Snarky Puppy lane on Spotify, and it just opened up all of these other venues. I know Spotify is a bad word, but I'll justify Spotify in a minute here. But I just started going down this rabbit hole and going, God, there's so much great stuff out there. And funk music makes me feel good. And I was tired of listening to music that was always dragging me down. And again, I still have a big appreciation for that kind of, you know, acoustic country rock stuff, but so much of the lyrics are just sad. And I would put myself in that place emotionally, and I was just tired of it. And so funk to me was like, oh my God, all of a sudden, there's this music that makes me feel good, and I can listen to it all day long, and I feel just as good at 5 o'clock as I did at 8 a.m. And that sort of spun off into where the radio show happened, and then of course the podcast. And so now I'm listening almost exclusively to funk these days, and funk byproducts, funk, jazz, soul, sure, and stuff like that, you know. And again, it's almost entirely selfish that I listen to it, because it makes me feel good. And I love listening to things that put a, you know, groove in my step and give me the funk face when something comes up, when you go, oh, you know, oh, it sounds so good, you know?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I think in your podcast with Cooking on Three Burners, I think it was, you talked about what is that the funk face is actually the ugliest face you can pull. And I laughed out loud when I listened to it, because when I get into a groove with the band, I mean, my face is so distorted, and I go, why am I making this absolute stupid face when the music is still really cooking, you know?
So funny, isn't
like
it?
Such a distorted grimace. And I'm not sure, what did you get to with the answer for that question?
Well, actually it was Choi. It was the drummer. He was the one who said funk face. I was just right off the back, oh yeah, that's funk face. When something sounds so good, your face looks terrible. I don't know. I can't understand. I can't. It just happens. You can't avoid it. Or explain it.
Yeah, I'm just thinking back to all those. I mean, I've made that face so many times, especially when I get to capture such great music in my studio and it's happening live, which is an incredible experience. I don't know what it is. It's just I can't put my finger on it. That's so interesting.
Well, that's why it's called funk. It has to be called something like that if it makes you do that, right?
Are you familiar with the Maceo Parker record, Live on Planet Groove?
I'm sure that I've heard it throughout my research for my radio show.
And I think the drummer of Cooking on Three Burners, he's actually referenced to Maceo, because to that long break, James, I'm derailing you. I'm not derailing you, but I'm just as an insert. he was talking about rhythm. I think it was Ivan or the drummer. Mm-hmm. And there's on that album, there's a first song. They call it Southwick, Shake Everything You Got. Like, Macy plays the solo, and he hangs, like, on one note forever and ever, and then he goes up in, like,
so
steps
good.
And steps, you know. And it's not about the lines. It's actually about the rhythm, and that was the point of the interview. Sorry, that just comes to mind. Sorry, James. Yeah.
No,
to you.
You totally got what I was going to say. It's because, like, what's so interesting, going from acoustic rock, one could say... And I'm not saying it's true, but one could say it's quite formulaic, you know, intro.
Is that one you?
I'm not saying anything at all.
I get it. I get it. Know, definitely formulaic.
Intro, verse, chorus, middle eight, chorus, outro. Thanks very much.
Yep.
Then exactly what Stefan just said. You've got Shake Everything You Got, 15 minutes long, possibly one, maybe two chord changes, maybe less.
Yeah.
So how was it for you listening to that? How were you able to sort of, I don't know, what was there, what was, how big was that leap, being it purely groove based?
Oh, it set me free.
Oh wow!
It totally cut off the shackles of you know, of songwriting as like an A B A B B C B, you know, formula. Why do we need rules? You know, I mean, Stefan knows this firsthand because he writes this kind of stuff all the time. I mean, to me now, as a songwriter, that's another whole area that I want to move into eventually, is writing music in that way, in that capacity, and being able to process that songs don't have to have a specific structure to them.
Totally. I mean, I really want to throw something in here, which I discussed with someone the other day. It was, see what you guys think of that. You know, a lot of the song form, like let's say A, B, that A and B repeats is probably has come out of classical music. And you find it in, I don't know, I think it's rondos or something like that, where you play the A section, like the melody of A, then you play B and then you play A again, and maybe variants of that.
So like theme and variation?
Yes, and one of the reasons why it was done was to actually make time, because before music was recorded, to actually go, it's all wild theorists, you know, so the academics will, you know, just gun for us now, but or me. So if Mozart went somewhere to perform, he had a certain like time slot to fill. So he would play the first thing and then the next thing, and that would have been very short. If you think about something like Little Night Music or something like that, mm-hmm. Is it called that, Little Night Music?
Eine kleine Nacht Music.
Ew, trick you out,
that's
Michael.
The one.
Yeah,
that's the one.
Nailing it. So there's repeats in it. And they're repeating it for practical reasons to actually make the length of the gig. Now, and that has been going on for so long that he's become something that maybe a practical reason have become part of the folklore. That's what we ought to do right now. So I'm making a big leap. Come to funk music, and you already mentioned Snarky Puppy. One of the cool things, and they're really debatable and to be discussed, if there's a material, an A section, in a B section, do we ever need to come back to A, or can we not just, instead of A, B, A, B, C, B, can we not just go A, B, C, D, E, keep on going? Yeah. And I have this sort of debates with my musician friends and go, well, is it old school to come back to the head? Like, you know, jazz standards, you have the head, you have the melody, and then you have some blowing over the changes, then you come back to the head. Is that old school? I've done a lot of writing like that, but recently I'm exploring to not come back, and I'm still scratching my head and go, is that all right to never come back? So that was a long sort of, sorry, like blah, blah, blah. But what do you guys think of that?
I'm going to pass it over to Michael first, our guest.
Well, I was going to say, I guess maybe it depends on what the intention of the song is. I think you could approach it on a song-to-song basis, but I think it also depends on what your motivation is. And especially if your song has lyrics, because, you know, everybody loves a good chorus that they can, you know, they can learn after the first two or three times, and then they can sing by the third or fourth time, and then they listen to the song again and they know it, you know. But if you're looking at something from a music composition standpoint that's maybe just instrumental, yeah, I mean, why do you need to repeat something if you've got something else coming down the line that's equally cool or equally groovy? You know, using music as your voice, you have something to say that is in section D or section E, but you're still in section B, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, what can I say about it? You could take the point or the point of view of the audience. If I was in the audience and say, Michael, you wrote a really great song, and the chorus was like absolutely banging, or like Section B was like incredible, and then you never played it again, I'd be like, oh, I want to hear that bit again because that was really good.
That's whenever you announce this album, this song is available on our records if you'll go buy one at the end of the show. So use it as an opportunity to sell merchandise, really.
Well,
that's what it all comes down to.
Yeah.
It's so interesting because, you know, you hear those arguments and they're all valid, I think, in my book anyway, that what you just described, James, is kind of equally bad and good. You know, on one hand, like, you know, repeat something that works. And on the other hand, hey, it was so great. Don't repeat it. Leave the audience hanging. Let them wait.
Yeah.
Let him kind of, what's he going to do next? You know?
Yeah.
And one more Snarky Puppy shout out. I mean, I love that band so much. And
absolutely.
The greatest gig of my life I've seen a few years back when they came to the Albert Hall. I think it was at the end of a world tour. That gig was like blowing my socks off and then some. And they won a Grammy for it, I think, for I don't know which category, but it was like, oh my God. I mean, I've seen a lot of gigs, but that was the best gig I've ever seen. And one of the things was that some of the arrangements had that sort of flowing thing to them where you just didn't know where it's going to go, you know? And I love that, you know?
Yeah. On that point, I'm very lucky to know the keyboard player, Bill Lawrence, who's a Brit.
Ooh. Nice.
And, sneak it in there.
Little name drop there.
Hey,
clang.
I was really lucky to see them in a pub in Brighton.
Wow.
In like an upstairs room. You can imagine Snarky Puppy in an upstairs room in an English pub, not the biggest venue in the world. But even then, that was just after they'd released Ground Up. They've done how many albums since? And it doesn't matter. But the one which was the second live album after Tell Your Friends, which was their first like live album in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Ground Up was their second live album in a bigger space. And we were singing the synth hook, like this like tiny audience in this pub were like singing the synth hook.
Oh,
it was
brilliant.
Oh yeah.
It was really cool, you know, off the first track, which I forget now what it's called. But and I then bought the DVD, and then Michael Leigh, he specifically says in the DVD, we get really bored live. So every gig is different. Every single gig, which totally fits into what you're saying, Steph, about like that feeling of like, I literally have no idea where they're going to go, because even they don't know where they're going to go.
Yeah.
Super cool.
And Ian, and coming back to what you said, Michael, it really depends on the overall outlook and the mission, you know, and you know, where you want to sit. You want to, like, you know, tell a story and come back to a chorus, or do you want to be more like a jazz exploration? Totally all valid.
Stefan, whenever you play with your band, do you have a plan? Or are there things that you specifically want your band members to be caught off guard and surprised with?
I try to answer that in short because it's your podcast and not mine. or I should be like the one being quiet and listening to you with James. Mm-hmm. Basically, because I've been trained as a sort of traditional like arranger, I used to have a very short leash on the band in terms of like a lot of prefabricated things that needed to be just so for it to be that thing that I wanted to hear at the end. And I've been doing this for a long time now. Now, as I'm growing older, I'm so enjoying the collaborative effort and actually going somewhere where it wasn't planned to go. They're just different approaches, and I actually love them all because I started out like that. I started out with hours of jamming and just seeing where it goes. And then when I became more academically trained, then I started to kind of like pre-think what's going down. And so, as I said, we talked about this before and probably...
And listeners.
Yeah,
listeners, if you'd like to hear the entire episode, please tune in today. 40 Minutes of Funk to hear the full interview with Stefan Rettenbacher.
There you go.
Yeah.
No, we should link to it. We'll link to it in the...
And also, Michael, where's my prize? And I hope I win it because it's called 40 Minutes of Funk, right?
That's
and
right.
I think it's 1 hour and 40 minutes or something like that. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
It is. Can
it
I
really
can I tell you guys?
Me.
Well, it was a great interview, and I had such a fun time because, I mean, we covered so many interesting things. I mean, we talked about Chinese government buying software, which, like, is not related directly to a music conversation, but it was that kind of intrigue was fun, right? But I will tell you that I learned a lesson from MasterLink sessions is that you guys took this interview with, there was a couple you had on there, a husband
yeah.
and wife.
Greta and Robin. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you split it into two. And I thought, oh my God, what a great idea. Why didn't I do that? Like, it's a great way to just, not only does it make sense to like have a shorter podcast, but it like draws the listener along like, oh, if I want to listen to part two, I have to wait until next week and hear like,
I was also.
I
just
learned
being
from
lazy.
That. I learned from you guys.
I just
no,
didn't,
I loved
I just
it.
Didn't want to edit it down. I was like, "There's no yeah, way I'm going to edit down yeah, 2 hours of podcast."
Oh, they went on like we're just cutting in half.
Yeah,
James, I did enjoy going. Welcome back to part two of our podcast.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was fun. I mean, you know, and bless you, Michael, because you said like at the beginning of this super, I'm dragging on, banging on with all my stupid stories. And you say, trust me, you know, if it gets long, you can't stop and you can come back to it. Try right. to sell it, the length of it all. Robin and Greta, they were absolutely fantastic. Brilliant. They have lots of things to say of lots of different places. So, yeah, we just couldn't stop them.
Yeah.
Stop them. But let's come back to your podcast. I also you told us a little bit about how you got to do the funk theme podcast.
Yeah.
So, but you know, you're actually the first fellow podcaster who we're talking to.
Yeah.
Yep. And so what is it like for you to host a podcast?
Well, first of all, I get to talk to funk people every week, and it's just so much fun. I mean, that the fun part of it makes the rest of it worthwhile. I mean, I don't know how you could talk about funk music and not have a good time. If you weren't having fun, then you're not doing funk right. I mean, it's literally in the word funk. It's fun. Right?
Oh, I never thought about that.
Never. But it's just fun. I mean, the hardest thing about my job is getting, there's two things that are hard about my job. And one is just to get artists and musicians who will reply and want to be on the show just because.
Really?
Well, it's just hard.
That's quite surprising.
That is. But yeah, that is surprising.
Well, I mean, especially the big cats, you know, and I'm not giving up. I mean, I'm going to keep on Herbie Hancock and Bootsy Collins. And, you know, I really want to have them on my show. And I'm hoping one of these days that this show will be big enough and they'll go, oh yeah, 40 minutes of funk. Yeah, I'll go do that. But the other thing is to get, to get the artists to help promote the episode. That doesn't always happen the way that I would like for it to, but I know artists are busy. They're touring and they're, you know, they're just trying to pay their bills too. So, but it's a blast. It's fun to, I'm at the point now where now I'm getting some bands contacting me and saying, hey, can we be on your podcast? And that's a cool place to be in. Cause yeah, it'd man. Be like, oh, now I get to turn the tables and check you out, you know, and see, and everybody so far I've been like, yeah, of course. And it's fun to hear what people are doing. Every band, every musician is different. I mean, I've had probably two or three people on the show. And one of the things that I ask every guest is that we talk about the philosophy of funk. It's what I call funk with a capital F, where you sort of transcend the genre of music and you think about the motivations and the philosophies behind funk music. And, everybody has a completely different answer. And that's,
oh wow,
that's one of the reasons that I'm doing that, is that I want listeners to go, wow, funk is more than just a section in the music store where you put certain kinds of CDs and records. It's an ideology. It's a way to think about not just a musical writing and performance perspective, but even a life perspective. And, you know, one of the things that comes up a lot is, you know, James Brown talking about being on the one. But even being on the one can be interpreted in many different ways, depending on the listener and the musician. And so it's just a total blast for me. I just get to sit back and talk to really cool people and play really cool music and just get to know people and make friends like I did with Stefan and now with James as a result. I mean, I just can't imagine anything more fun than that, except maybe getting on stage and playing with people like that.
Can you just delve a bit more into being on the one, just because that's quite interesting, or what you've learned from it or whatever?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. So whenever I started, whenever I pitched the radio show idea, which by the way, so I have a friend who works at KGOU studio in Norman. As I mentioned, it's the local NPR affiliate. And the guy's name is Jim Johnson, and he's been running a blues show for 20 years. It's called The Weekend Blues. And he's just the best that there is. He is such a great host and just a cool person and just really loves and appreciates blues music. And he kind of does a similar thing where it's blues, but it's also things that are maybe outliers that are tied to blues as well, including funk. He'll play some funk on there occasionally. And I've known Jim for several years, and I've been a big, you know, fan of his show and listening for a long time. And I went to him in 2019. We went to lunch and I said, you know, Jim, I've been listening to all this funk music and I've started tracking just a small list of albums, records and bands that I think might make for a cool radio show, but I don't know how to do radio. What do you think about doing a music podcast about me doing, do you have any insight, any feedback, any sort of tips or tricks? And he said, well, if you do a music podcast, and I'm just talking about like playing songs, you know, and he said, the copyright issues with that will bury you. You know, record labels want to be paid. You can't just put music on the radio, even on the air, even just for a podcast. And he said, I'm actually shopping for a new program for KGOU. He said, I know you. I know your work ethic. I know the kind of music you like. He said, what would you think about doing a radio show? And I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, I got a job. I got a family. I'm in a band, a couple of bands. Like, how am I going to do that? He's like, well, just think about it. See if it's something that you want. And after he planted that in my brain, I couldn't say no at that point. And so I took a year to research before we actually signed the paperwork and launched. So during that time, I was picking up every funk book that I could find. And one of the very best ones that's out there is by Ricky Vincent. It's just called Funk, the music that people on the one. And in it, he talks about that James Brown came up with this concept of being on the one. And so musically, when James Brown when he released Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, which was 1964 or 65, the music in it on that album was different than anything else he had done before. And this is why he's called the Godfather of Soul. But if you listen to any song on that record, you're going to hear a boom, da 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 da, boom, doop bop beat, you know, whatever. But his whole thing was, you know, everybody puts the emphasis on the two and four. But he said, music needs to have the emphasis on the one now. Music is changing. It's time to change. And so from that point on, everything was on the one. So you have this musical theory concept that you're going to put the emphasis on the first beat of every measure, right? Which, I mean, makes sense. But where he was going with that became more of a philosophy and an idea that being on the one can mean things more than just the musical terminology of putting music on the first beat. It can be about, like, for me, being on the one is about equality. We are all on the one, no matter our background, no matter our race, religion, gender, age, any of that thing. We are all on the one, which means that we're all equal. And that's just my personal take on that particular philosophy. But a lot of other people, you know, you listen to my interview with Sean Martin, again, mentioned Snarky Puppy. He talks about being on the one is that he makes sure that all of his bases are covered, that being on the one for him is he's got bills to pay. You pay your bills on time. That's being on the one. Whenever you show up for a gig, you're going to do your job and be focused and do your part and play, you know, part of a bigger role. You're being on the one. And so that being on the one can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. And it's just a cool concept. And like I said, I've had several people on the show who've talked about being on the one, and it's a little bit different for every person based on their experience and their perspectives.
Cool. Thank you.
That's yeah. Awesome.
A wonderful excursion on what it could mean being on the one, and it can be multitudes of things.
That's brilliant. Right.
There's this great clip of Bootsy Collins where he explains the concept in a, I think it's a bass instruction video where he talks about that. Cracks me up every time.
If you can hear Bootsy Collins talk about being on the one, there's no better explanation than to hear him talk about it. He's got it. I mean, this guy lives it. That's like, to me, I want to eventually understand it to a point where I live it. This guy doesn't have to think about it. He lives it, breathes it. It's just part of his DNA. And it's just fantastic to hear him anytime talk about funk philosophy like that.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the architects. I mean, he wrote the book. He was there with James Brown and his brother. And they kind of created the stuff. So he gave us the book in a way.
Yeah,
the book of
exactly.
Funk, you know, and Boots is one of the architects. So,
yeah.
Brilliant. One of the things I'm totally surprised that James hasn't brought up yet is that you used to run a recording studio.
Oh, yes.
And you also a live sound engineer.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I wondered if James would pick up on that.
I read it, but then we just got sidetracked with funk, which is fun, much more fun.
Right.
But yeah, tell us about your recording studio.
Yeah, so I owned a very small recording studio in Southwest Oklahoma for about 3 years. And the way I came about that was that I was in a band that had been recording an album, and our drummer owned the studio. He ended up becoming our drummer, so we got to record for significantly cheaper. You know, always make friends with the studio engineers, guys. I'm just saying. It's a good investment. Right, James?
That's right.
so he wanted to get out of recording and do some other things. And so he knew that I would sit behind him and watch him do stuff on, you know, on the mix and on the computer and on the Alesis machines that we had. And, I got to the point where I started running things, and he could get up and go do other things, and I could keep things rolling. And I was like, God, this is really fun. And I understand the concept of how this all works. Right. And so he said, you know what? I want to get out of this. Would you be interested in buying my studio? So long story short, my father-in-law and I converted a small space into a recording studio, and I started using that as a way to supplement my income whenever I left one sort of big job and took a really small part-time job to stay at home with our daughter who had just been born. So this is, you know, 18 years ago.
Mm. James can relate to that, I think.
Yeah. Are you looking to sell?
No.
No, it's just like... trying to run a studio whilst having a young family.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough. Get your son in there and get him to record just vocalizations. Like,
I promise you, in
15 years, you'll go back and go, oh, I missed that sound. Yeah. I missed that voice. Right. It's so special.
I had him with some headphones on, and I put loads of delay and reverb on. He was just making these. He was going like, ah, it would be like, ah. He was like, whoa.
Right.
It was really cool.
Right.
Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, so take advantage of that technology that you've got, that equipment,
yeah, totally.
To preserve some of that. Yeah. So I recorded a number of basically local acts. There was a bluegrass band and some local hip-hop guys. I had some friends who did some studio work. The best thing that came out of my studio at all, I did some solo stuff from that. I did about 75% of a solo project from that. And that's not what the best stuff is. I'm just throwing that in there too. But my father, so my dad is a pianist and actually was a church organist. That's how my mom and he met whenever they were in their 20s. And so I always grew up with my father playing piano in the house. And he would, at Christmas time, he would break out some Christmas songs and stuff like that. And so one year I said, Dad, why don't you record an album of Christmas music, just solo piano stuff? And he was like, well, I'm not very good. I don't blah. I said, Dad, it'll just be for our family. I don't care. Just would you do it? And he did. And he ended up picking out like 12 or 15 songs. And I recorded those. And every year at Christmas, I pull that CD out and throw it in. And we get to hear Dad playing the piano.
Right.
And so it was just such a cool, that is one of those things that's priceless. Like there's nothing on the planet that comes even close to having the memory of something like that. And years after my dad is gone, he will still be with us in the form of those songs. It's just a cool, to me, that was like, I don't care about the rest of the stuff I recorded. Just knowing that I was able to make that happen was worth all of it.
Wow, that's beautiful. Great. Yeah, that's great. What a great story.
How long did you run the recording studio for?
So that was about 3 years. And it was just a 24 track setup. I had these three Alesis 8-channel digital recorders that would sync up. And it was great because right before that, the guy had the tape versions of those. So he had like these VHS cassettes that you would put in there.
Oh,
you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I remember those.
Yeah. Okay. So every time you had to stop and go back, you had to physically rewind them back and then they had to realign. So it's like, and then you could hit record. So these were the digital version of that. So much faster. Yeah. But yeah. And then of course, whenever we ended up moving to another town, I took a different job and I sold off most of that gear. And now, you know, technology's changed so much that you can do digitally now without even needing any sort of hardware. I mean, you do need hardware, but you can do the same thing that I was doing with a lot less.
Yeah. It's so cool that you were doing the local thing. I think it's such a great recording studios, especially sort of 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you know, when you couldn't do it at home. You know, you're creating such a wonderful archive of a community at that point in time, and the sound and what people are dealing with. I think it's a great thing, and especially if you're not doing it for sort of, you know, like massive commercial success. You know, it's just, I just want to try out having running a recording studio. It's a very cool thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're recording stuff that you're giving them merchandise. You're giving them stuff that they can sell to help, you know, pay for the gas to get them back home after a gig. Or, you know, nowadays you can drop stuff online so that anybody in the world can hear you, which you couldn't even do, you know, 15 years ago.
But yeah, you can drop it online and buy three pieces of corn for your chicken. Yeah.
Oh,
Seth. You've made enough to buy three pieces of corn?
Yeah, I'm very successful. I'll let you know.
Both of my bands, the first, when I dropped my album online, we got $25 right away, like within the first month, because all of our friends and family were, you know, paying for downloads. And then there would be a year and we might get another $25. It's just like, you don't do it for the money, you know, you do it just because you want people to hear your stuff. But
Wow. So what took you on the road then and became, you've become and still are, I think, you're like a live audio engineer.
Yeah. Well, and I, of course, over the year, I've got a good ear. I feel like I've got a good ear for mixing. Probably not nearly as good as James's is, but just good enough to be able to know kind of how to scoop the EQs and get things where they're supposed to be so you can hear stuff. And so as a result of that, I mean, I've run sound for, you know, my own bands, for other bands and things like that. And even today, I'll play with other, like we'll have like three bands that play together over like 4 hours, and we'll just take turns and stuff. We call it bandemonium. and I'll, you know, whenever I'm off the stage, you know, Jim will hand me the iPad and I've got to run sound for his band and stuff like that. So just the tie between live music and studio music on a fundamental level is really, you know, pretty similar. Of course, there's lots of nuance in each of those if you go into the, you know, each of those separately. But yeah, so I always, you know, tell people that I can run sound, but you can't afford me. I don't enjoy just going out and running sound for people. It's just a lot of work and not very much money in it. So, but I enjoy it to a certain degree. I mean, there's nothing worse than being at a live show and going, why can't I hear the keyboardist? Where's the keyboardist? I can see him playing. I can't hear the keyboardist. Am I the only one not hearing the keyboardist? You know, that's part of what happens. James, do you do that do you listen to records and do that?
Not so much with records, because I think whenever I listen to records, I now have an appreciation for just like taste. You know, people have different tastes. People want to portray different things, and live is different. Like live, I saw a band recently, and the vocal was right on the edge of feeding back, and I was like itching. I'm like, can't you just adjust it a little, just a little bit? Go on, please.
You want so badly to walk over to the sound guy and go, listen, I know you don't know who I am, but I know what I'm doing. Can you just...
They love that.
Oh, they really love it. Being a sound guy, I love that.
Right? There's been times when I've gotten up and my wife's like dragging me back. Jeez. How could they not hear that?
Oh, yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Funny. The best sound the best venue I ever did was, Steph, have you been to, actually, or Michael, have you been to, oh, where is it? It's not the Sage. It's not Gateshead. It's the other one. It's the one in Liverpool. Damn, what's it called?
I've never been to Liverpool.
Steph, what's it called?
It's, I have been to Liverpool, but don't know.
Okay, never mind.
Epic fail.
Yeah, that was a big fail there. Never mind.
Just put it back in and post. Be like, the Royal Theatre.
I'll put it here. Okay. The venue is essentially like a dead studio. It was amazing. So any reverb and delay, you could actually flip and hear it. And it was such a joy. And the music was really, it was a lovely lady called Judy Zook, who's an 80s artist. And she was sort of redoing all of her old hits. And it's great. It was so great being able to actually put a delay on it with some verb and go, yes, that sounds really cool. Because some venues sound like absolute shite.
Yeah.
I tell you, like a really cool venue to play in, an outdoor venue, is the desert. And I played this gig once at next to Masada, which is in Israel. And so we played in the desert, and it was, wow, what a great sound for a bassist, because it is so dry, there is nothing coming back.
Just sucks up your frequencies.
I think I was actually able to put some reverb on bass and still hear it. And reverb and bass, I mean, in any other venue, I mean, forget it. I mean, you're lucky if you can make out the pitch normally in bass. No, I mean, bass is like probably the biggest horrible thing to get right. And I've seen many, many acts with wonderful musicians and wonderful sound engineers. But getting bass right is just like, oh, my God. You know, it's very, very, very hard, if not borderline impossible.
It was the Lowry in Salford.
Did you just Google that, James?
I did. I had to. I couldn't live with myself.
What's it called?
The Lowry.
Oh, okay.
The Lowry in Salford. Not Liverpool.
You've heard it here, people.
Talking of
Larry,
bass players,
go play there if you can.
Oh, it's lovely. Talking of bass players and gigs, the bass player on that gig, and I will name him Jimmy Sims, lovely bass player. He would wind me up something chronic when doing sound check. He'd be playing bass, and if this was his microphone, he'd go.
So that is just so.
I'd be like, where
just
the,
a mess with you?
Where the that F? Yeah. Where's that coming from? And I'd be like turning every knob, moving every flipping fader. And I'd be like, Jimmy, was that you? And he'd be like, no.
I'm not sure, but I can hear this weird noise. Can't you hear it?
I've been known to do that when my buddy Jim is running sound.
I'll just be like, you bad man. You're a bad man.
Like, I was like, you can't hear that? He's like, what?
Yeah, that's terrible.
And then we laugh a lot, which, you know, is important. Well, I will say, James, for your benefit, as a musician, as much fun as I have playing live, and that is absolutely one of the most fun things you can do.
Oh yeah,
I don't know that I've ever had more fun than when I'm in the studio. That is, there's something magical that happens when you're laying down tracks and things just kind of come to you that maybe you hadn't considered. You know, you can do all the prep in the world for it, but you get in the studio, there's some magic and that's the word for it. And then like you go, oh, hey, what if we added this? What if we did this? And then all of a sudden there's like you hearing things that you've never heard before in your own music. And I love that process so much. I mean, I love going, doing a 12-hour studio session and then just being completely exhausted because my brain is just fried from all of the creativity. And that's something that only happens in the studio. I love it. I love it so much. So thank you for providing opportunities for musicians to do that very thing.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
That's right, James. Thank you. I'm going to tag on there. And talking about exciting things and love for music, maybe to wind our podcast down, we would love to know what you are looking forward to creating 2022.
Obviously expanding the podcast and trying to get not only more listeners and get financial support for that, but also just continuing to bring in great, you know, musicians as I have been. I really need to get a woman on the show. I need to get a female funk master on the show. They're hard to find, but maybe you guys can help me with that. But I really want to get...
Oh, I know someone.
Okay, good.
Okay.
But definitely I'm going to start with my art, doing a lot more of self-promotion for that and working on, you know, when you're in a band, you know how it is to hustle. You're always trying to find venues. You're trying to make, you know, connections and you're trying to get your music out there. And I finally have kind of gotten over the hump of that with some of the bands that I'm in making some of those connections. And I just figured out that art's going to be the same way. And I have to start from scratch. I was like, oh, but the good news is I have an idea for how to kind of do that because I've done it before with music. So definitely expanding more paintings, more, hopefully more art shows, more festivals, getting some of those things out there. The other area is I think it's time that I start a funk band.
Yeah. Come on.
I'm at the point where I can't not do it anymore. And I'm having some conversations with some really, really cool people in the Norman area who are great musicians and have a great love for funk and soul music. So that's probably going to be something that blossoms this year. And I am just totally excited to think about the potentials for that.
That's brilliant. And will you play? I've seen you read a Victor Wooten book the other day on Instagram or something like that. So will you play the bass in the band?
If I could play funk style bass, I would in a heartbeat. I am not confident. I have no training, first of all. I have no training as a bass player or really as a guitarist, but I don't know funk method. And I don't know anybody locally who could teach me that. And I would frankly rather hand the bass over to somebody who knows what they're doing and just trust them and let them do their own thing. So
you sing?
I'm thinking at this point I'm going to front the band and sing and do rhythm guitar, because rhythm is really my baby. I mean, I love playing rhythm, and I would love nothing more than to play rhythm and let the lead guitarist get out there and play, let the bass player do his thing, let the horns do their thing, you know. So that's kind of where I'm at.
What's it going to be called? Do you know yet?
No, not yet. I have a couple of ideas, but I can't. I can't
gonna
drop that yet.
I'm going to hold it close to my chest. Yeah, I'm like, you know, I'm going to be secretive now. It's good, people. You got to come back for the next installment. So
yeah, we need to find out.
It will be the big reveal.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like a fun time. That's a good idea.
That's great.
That sounds brilliant. And I think you mentioned in one of the podcasts there is a funk blues type of festival near you. Will you perform at that one? There's an open air festival you mentioned.
Yeah, we have a Jazz in June festival each year that usually what they'll do is like they'll do a blues night and a funk night and a jazz night. And so obviously I'm now getting more tied into the funk side of that festival, but there's definitely some potential opportunities if I put a band together and, you know, we're able to do some shows. But you know how it is when you get a big band, we're going to automatically just cut off a lot of our audience just because we don't have the venues to fit a 9-person band, you know. So
well, I'll go back to Snarky Puppy playing in a pub in Brighton. There you go. It was a squeeze. There's no doubt.
Yeah. Well, we need some good pubs that have live music first. Let's just say that. At least in Oklahoma.
Yeah, I've never been. One fine day. On that note, Michael, it's been like, what a wonderful pleasure talking to you and hearing about your endeavors. So really, really cool. I hope we can do this again in some other form, this form, whatever. I mean, it's been really good fun. And,
I've had such a blast. I've been thinking for weeks about this, like just like I could not wait for it to finally happen. Like I've just been so excited and listening to Masterlink sessions, been like, okay, this person said this, and oh my God, they are way more interesting than I am. And oh God, can I even go on this
show? Oh my
show?
God,
and,
no.
You know,
but no.
You guys are great. You guys have been wonderful. I have enjoyed listening to the podcast, and maybe even more so just being on here and talking with you guys and getting to know you better.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah. Thanks for doing what you're doing. Keep it up.
Thank you.
Same to you.